You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today. Okay, let's do some quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. That's obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. To reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. Here's the thing. Information is power. Information is money. Literally, the currency of today's world of entrepreneurship is information. And if you could bring all of the information about your business into one dashboard, this is incredibly valuable. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of the truth about your business. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, access from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. And you're improving efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. This is so valuable. You just hit a button and you can see all the information about your business instead of having to like call five different departments and get all these emails and put it all together and make sense of it. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James. netsuite.com/James.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network.
So Mitch Lowe, thanks for coming on to the James Altucher Show.
Thanks, James. Nice to be here.
Now, Mitch, every website, biography, interview with you says you're the co-founder of Netflix. You're also the founder of Redbox, and you're the current CEO of Quarterly, which is a site I want to talk about. But let me ask you first about Netflix. Is that okay?
Okay. Absolutely.
Now, when I think of Netflix, I think of Reed Hastings. I have never heard of you in the context of Netflix.
Well, you probably haven't heard of a lot of the key people that really started Netflix. A guy named Mark Randolph, who I really credit as the true founder and creator, was a guy who worked for Reed as his VP of corporate marketing at a company called Pure Atria that Reed had sold in 1998 to Rational Software.
Okay. And so tell me how Netflix got started, because obviously it's one of the
sure.
best companies on the planet now.
It is, and we created an amazing culture there that continues to be a strong company. So the way it started is in 1998, a company that Reed owned called Pure Atria was sold in July of that year to Rational Software, a much bigger software company.
Yeah, and they got bought eventually by IBM.
Yeah, exactly. And Mark Randolph, who was Reed's corporate VP of marketing, had just seen that the first titles of DVD had come out in March of that year. And he had this idea where he thought, well, geez, unlike VHS, DVDs way under an ounce, Therefore, they could be put in a first class, mailed with a first class postage stamp. They were affordable, whereas, you know, VHS, the average wholesale price was about $72. And so we had this idea of doing a by-mail business. This wasn't a subscription business. This was what he really wanted to do was be the Amazon of DVD, both in rental and sales. And I was, meanwhile, I was the chairman of the what was called the VSDA at the time. It was the Video Software Dealers Association. So it was all the video stores around the country, Blockbuster, Hollywood, all the independents. And I also had a little company where I was building websites, for video stores that would allow them on a subscription basis to sell movies online, distribute an email newsletter, and Mark attended a trade show in July of 98 where he and I met, and he shows up at my booth with this backpack and is wearing sandals and kept asking me all these questions about DVD, and I could tell he had some interesting idea, but he wouldn't tell me what it was exactly, and I even remember him about ready to walk away without giving me his name. And I remember grabbing the back of his backpack and pulling him back and saying, wait a minute, you know, we should talk some more.
Oh, my God. So if you hadn't, like, pulled on his backpack, there might not be a Netflix?
Well, I think there still would have been a Netflix, but, you know, it wouldn't, you know, I mean, I'd like to think it wouldn't have been the same.
There might not have been a House of Cards, for instance.
That's possible. Well, you know, Ted Sarandos was my distributor rep for the chain of video stores I owned. And in, I can't remember the year, but when Reed wanted me to move to Los Angeles to run content, I had just had dinner with Ted a couple days before at the Video Hall of Fame dinner. And my wife and I decided that we weren't going to move to Los Angeles. So I remember talking Ted into taking the job. I remember sitting in a car in the heat for 45 minutes trying to convince Ted that the internet was here to stay. And he finally joined and ran content. But so Mark and I started meeting on a weekly basis at a place called Buck's Cafe in Woodside, which, you know, had all kinds of, you know, positive, you know, experiences in. That's where Jeffrey Yang came up with Yahoo and, you know, a few other cool things happened there. And then one day he brought in Reed, who had agreed to fund his idea to build a company that would rent and sell movies. And
weren't you guys worried, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but weren't you guys worried that, well, if Amazon's selling books, it's just easy for them to sell DVDs, which they did end up doing?
Yeah, we at the time we were more worried about Walmart, but we were in general worried about anybody who could sell below cost. We always saw that, you know, rental, we were a la carte rental. You could rent for $4.99 for 1 week rental plus 99 cents shipping and handling. And we sold movies essentially at cost. We were worried about it, but we saw the sales of DVDs more as a customer acquisition vehicle than making money at it.
I see. So renting was like the main source of profit.
Yeah. Renting was where it was at. And, you know, of course, you know, our office, which was in Scotts Valley, California, near Santa Cruz, was filled with all kinds of test gadgets, trying to see just how much you could bend a DVD disc before it snapped, because we knew it would go through all these rollers in the U.S. mail distribution.
Now, I remember at the time, or maybe this was a little bit afterwards, I was thinking about Netflix, and I was thinking to myself, you know, it's just easy for me to go over to the video store, which now rents out DVDs. If I want to see a movie, I want to see it today. I don't want to wait in the mail.
Yeah, that's exactly that 2 or 3 day delay had a huge negative impact in the early days on the business, because you might be in the mood for a comedy when you ordered the film, but 2-3 days later, you might be in the mood for a drama. And, you know, in those days, we saw a huge difference in retention and, you know, the percentage of households, DVD households that were customers based on how long it took to get the movie. You know, around our San Jose warehouse, you know, all around the Southern Bay of San Francisco, we had huge, perfect retention numbers. And I think we had at one time 5% of all DVD households, where it was less than 1%, you know, anywhere else. So, yeah, that delay was huge. But, you know, we always knew that we were going to migrate onto digital. You know, we could have called the company Movies by Mail, but, you know, at the very beginning, we called it Netflix because we knew that, you know, we didn't know whether it would be downloading or streaming at the time, but we always knew that we would go to some form of digital delivery.
Well, and I want to ask about that, but first I want to ask, how did you market yourself? How did you get your initial customers? How did you educate people that this was a market?
We did it in a couple ways, and it was really fun. The first and most impactful way was, we went to all the DVD manufacturers, you know, Sony, Toshiba, Matsushita, et cetera, and we said, listen, your people are trying to sell these DVD players, and at the time, consumers are going, wait a minute, all I see is VHS everywhere, and most of the video stores have a small selection of DVD. You know, it wasn't really until 2000, you know, the year 2000, before video stores really started, you know, having a wide selection. So we said, no matter where a customer buys your DVD player, no matter where they live, you know, if they join Netflix, they can get every single title available. And that will give the salespeople, you know, in Best Buys and other places who are selling your product, here's what you're going to feed into this thing, and here's where you get it. And those partnerships, what we did is we would give them 8 free rental coupons, 10 free rental coupons to put inside the player boxes. So we ended up having an offer in about 95% of all the DVD players sold in the country inside the box. So right as you open the box, there was our big license plate size coupon.
And
so that evolved into a free trial. But originally it started out as a la carte rental.
So no DVD player company wanted an exclusive with you? Like, they were all happy to talk to you?
They did. They did. And, you know, we encountered the same problem at Redbox. But, you know, we made the argument that all ships rise, you know, when you have this accessibility. Sony wanted the best deal. So Sony got 10 free rentals while everybody else got 8. But that was only because they had a dominant market share.
So it's very interesting. Like, every company has its own unique way to market their product. Like, people always say, how can I market my product? But you really have to be clever and figure out the subtleties of your industry and then come up with the exact way. But it usually involves some sort of giveaway.
Yeah, giveaways are good. We also, the other big things we did, we're always trying crazy things. One of the craziest things we did was, back in 1999, making DVD was not easy. The connection technology was different from players. And months tested and have a master that you could get a DVD out of it. And somebody came to us, and they had developed software where they claimed they could turn content into a DVD in 24 hours. And so when the Clinton interrogation by the Senate, his Senate hearing, was broadcast and was public domain, we put out a big press release where we got a full page in the Wall Street Journal where we said, you know, give us your 2 cents and we'll send you a DVD with the entire, Senate interrogation on it, all with chapter stops. So you could even go straight to, you know, his answers on specific topics.
That's great.
And we turned that around and we ended up selling 20,000 copies of that for 2 cents a piece. And it really got our name, you know, out there that, now, you know, a couple of those discs had porn on them accidentally. We never got those back from the customers, but, you know, it was, those were different kind of fun, different ways to get the word out about who we are.
Wait, let me try to understand this. Some had porn on them accidentally.
So what happened, you know, cause we were trying to do this quick. In fact, I don't think I slept for 48 hours. We took the master to a reproduction house in the South Bay of San Francisco, and this company also made discs of pornography, and they accidentally mixed in when we went to pick up our discs from them. We were doing every couple hours, picking them up, sending, shipping them out, coming back, picking up more. There accidentally got to be a batch of discs that weren't ours in the batch that we sent out to customers.
And no one was fired over this?
You know, we got some bad publicity out of it, but, you know, we sent a request to all those customers to send them back, and we'd replace it with the right disc, and no one ever sent it back to us. So it kind of just blew over.
Maybe everyone thought, oh, I asked for the Clinton proceedings. Maybe this is the accurate Clinton proceedings. Maybe this right. is not it's a mistake.
Like, that's right. And I think that's common, you know, to take names of movies and slightly change them for adult content.
Right. So, but Netflix, though, continued mailing DVDs to people until really just a few years ago, and I never could really understand it.
Yeah, well, it still does. It's still, I mean, the funny thing is that the you know, they spun it out to an independent entity called Quickster, but that's still in operation and still does quite well. There's still, you know, if you look at the household makeup of the United States, they really fall into two big segments. One segment, which is kind of the Netflix customer that's really is willing to pay to get the right content at the right time on the right device. And another, you know, segment, which is more the Redbox customer and more now the Quickster or the Movies by Mail, where it's more about filling time at the most affordable price. And those customers are still, you know, a good half of the households in the U.S. So DVD continues to be strong.
So when did Netflix go public? Like, when did you start to see for yourself personally financial benefit from Netflix?
Well, we first were going public. We had Deutsche Bank bringing us public in, of all times, April of 2001. And, of course, you know, the market, the dot-com bubble burst, and we pulled that. And we went public in May of 2002, at $15 a share pre-split. So it's split since then, but we came out at $15 a share in May of 2002.
And then at that point, did you suddenly make like a massive amount of money? Was this like great for you? Did you have a party?
We had a party. We had, we rented a boat on the bay and all went out. But, you know, many of us had seen a lot of our friends get paper rich during the dot-com bubble and then watch them lose it all. And so, you know, and one of the reasons why Netflix was able to go public, you know, just a year after the bubble burst was that we were all pretty kind of grounded, you know, kind of even people where, you know, we weren't in it to make lots of money. it was really nice, and we all made lots of money, but you know, we were pretty grounded. So it was probably another year. You know, I left in January of 2003, and I went back to visit sometime in late 2003, and I think it was only then that you could see the parking lot, you know, start to change from old Volvos and, you know, old VWs to brand new cars.
Huh. Well, you know, again, I remember this was about maybe 6 or 7 years ago. Some short selling hedge fund called me and made this super persuasive argument why Netflix was a short. And it was precisely at that point, I think Netflix kind of multiplied by 4 in stock price. Like, Netflix just kept going. But nobody believed the model, and Netflix proved them wrong.
Yeah. Well, you know, Reed, you know, is one of the most amazing leaders. You know, he and I shared a cube together for a couple years, and I learned more than I think I could ever have learned from any kind of MBA program or any type of education I could have ever gotten.
What are 3 things you think you learned from him?
Number 1 was focus. No matter how many things you think you can do and how many things look attractive, find that one thing you know you can be absolutely the best on it, and force yourself to drop all the others. And that's hard. That is really hard. At, you know, at one point, early on, this is like in 2001, we were already, we had built a sales department that was selling the space on the envelope, you know, for advertising.
Yeah.
And these salesmen had signed up all these deals. And one time, because the buyer did not approve the artwork and we had to go back into print, it delayed the envelope such that a mailing to customers was delayed, and Reed shut down the entire department and said, listen, if we can't deliver movies on time all the time, then I don't want to have it. I don't care if we can make $20, $30 million from it. It's not our core business. And that was an amazing lesson for me. I still find myself, you know, find it very difficult to turn down opportunities. And Reed is a master at that, is getting people focused on that one thing you can do really, really well.
It's interesting because I had a podcast recently that I did with Peter Thiel, and he said the one thing he learned at PayPal is give everything their one thing to do. Like, nobody should be in charge of 2 things. So it's a similar type of idea.
It is. And it runs counter to, you know, lots of, you know, other theories about, you know, keeping work interesting, you know, such that you don't feel like a automaton, you know, just kind of taking a widget and moving it to the right. But it really does work. So that was one thing. That was the first one. The second one was he taught me how you use analytics to make decisions. I always thought that you needed a clear answer before you made a decision. And the thing that he taught me was you've got to use analytics directionally as opposed to and never worry whether they are 100% sure. Just try to get them to point you in the right direction. And so he just taught me a whole different way of using the numbers and the analysis of performance.
Like, what's an example of
directional.
That?
You know, an example might be that we had at the time, we couldn't figure out what our core demographic was of our users. And so we would spend bunches of time surveying our customers, trying to figure out, you know, do they fit into the 18 to 24-year-old group and 24 to 35, et cetera. And, you know, the numbers were all over the place. But if you averaged them all out, it was clear that our customer was higher income, older, and more educated. But, you know, there were still big segments of younger people. And he said, listen, you know, just go with where this is telling you directionally our customers are. And it really paid off, you know, when we started targeting places where those customers, you know, with that demographic hung out, you know, and this kind of got to our annoying pop-up ads that we used to inundate the web with, then, you know, our customer acquisition just, you know, went straight up.
So you started targeting just that group, and that's how you cheaply got customers.
Yeah, and that kind of led to the third thing, which is kind of you know, he always said, you know, we would always try to make everything improve. Like, you know, we've tried to raise you know, all segments of our company or our revenue from all different customer segments. And he would say to us, you know, instead of trying to make the bad ones better, just take the ones that are already doing good and pour a lot more money into making them great. And so, and that turned out to be a really kind of smart way to go, because what we ended, you know, and it had the same thing was true with movies, with customers, with, you know, different, you know, with people. You know, he always believed that you've got to cut people who are medium to poor performers, you know, cut them out of the organization and put more money into the ones that are overperforming. And same thing with movies, buy more copies of the hit movies rather than try to get more people to rent the slow movie.
So this is kind of like the 80-20 rule, that like 20% of your employees will do 80% of the work, 20% of your customers result in 80% of the profits, and so on.
Yeah, exactly. It's exactly that. And it worked.
So why did you decide to leave the company?
I ask myself that a lot. You know, back in 2002, when we went public, I was running my role was, I was VP of business development and strategic alliances. So, you know, I was working with companies like Best Buy and the manufacturers and so on, the DVD manufacturers, as ways to drive subscribers. But I also had a stealth project, which was called Netflix Express, which I don't think there's been much written about it. But Netflix Express was designed to shorten that amount of time that it took to get a DVD disc to a consumer. You know, remember, at this point, we were opening little mini warehouses all over the place to kind of get to that one-day ship for most of the country. And we had one other thing that we were doing, which it was a vending machine that we would put in grocery stores and other places where you could pick up your movies, you could become a new subscriber, you could drop off your movies and immediately exchange them for ones that were in stock at the grocery store. And so I set up this project in Las Vegas, which was a great test market, and it just was going crazy. I mean, in the first couple weeks, we signed up like 900 new customers at this one grocery location. And it was phenomenal, but Reed, after, you know, a month or so of this really doing well, Reed came to me and said, hey, listen, the board wants you to shut that down. And his reasoning was that if the investment community, you know, by the way, our stock over those couple months, this is around November of 2002, remember, we had gone public in May. Our stock had dropped from $15 down to $9 during that time. And Reed told me that if the investment community heard that we were opening these physical locations, which were really these automated vending machine locations, he thought that the investment community would penalize us and our stock would even drop further. And so he asked me to shut it down. And, you know, I haven't told you my background. Back in the early 80s, I had developed a vending machine business for VHS that failed miserably. And I always saw this as a way to kind of resurrect this failed idea of the past. And it hurt me so much to have to shut this down that I started looking elsewhere. And at this time, the guys at McDonald's came out and asked me if I would help them open a DVD vending business because their business, their traffic at the McDonald's restaurants had been dropping. And they thought if they rented movies, they might be able to increase traffic because you have to return the movie, not only rent it. So it adds this incremental visit. And so they essentially lured me away. In February, I went to consult with McDonald's, and then I became an employee in May. Meanwhile, after I left Netflix, Reed had asked me to go to England and Germany and Japan as a consultant to help explore expanding Netflix in those countries. But by the time I finished that project in April, I was free to join McDonald's as an employee, which I did.
Help
them build their venue.
You went from Netflix to being an employee of McDonald's.
Yeah, I know. I know.
That's probably the strangest. Like John Scully went from Pepsi to Apple, and you went like the exact opposite direction.
Yeah. Well, I had made the argument to Reed that we should run McDonald's business. We should run their vending business to rent movies. And he said, I don't want anything to do with McDonald's. And even though I'm not a, you know, McDonald's eater, I just thought it, you know, I guess I was still trying to vindicate my failure of the 80s with vending machines, which was called the Video Droid. I was still trying to vindicate that. So, you know, emotions can take a big role in decision making.
Sure, sure. You know, let me ask you a quick question. What was the most popular movie rented while you were there at Netflix?
Well, I know the answer. I definitely can tell you the first two titles that we bought lots of copies of, which was L.A. Confidential and Boogie Nights. We bought 248 copies of each one of those, and you know, they were our most, and in fact Warner Brothers gave us $20,000 to put a full page ad in the Chronicle, the San Francisco Chronicle, promoting it. So those were our first two big titles.
So this is all very interesting, and I want to actually get into your current stuff, because I think with your current business it actually enables people to build their own businesses, which is what I'm very excited about. But I want to ask one more thing about Netflix. Like, it seems like Netflix has quite successfully gone in the direction of HBO, Showtime, and other companies that aggregated movies, but then turned into original programming. And Netflix was sort of the first digital-only company that created amazingly successful original programming. And I don't know if you keep up with the management there or anything, but this must have been a huge kind of management shift in decision-making to go into original programming and actually produce shows.
Yeah, well, you know, Reed has always wanted, you know, his dream has always been to be, you know, a studio, like to run a studio.
I did not know that.
And Ted is probably the most knowledgeable content guy out there. I mean, there's no one I know who, like Ted, who you can talk about a film and he'll know everything about, you know, almost any obscure piece of content. So they definitely have the right, you know, both passion for it and the knowledge of it. But the most important part, and this is I'm finding it is a fascinating trend, where the Netflix not only and knows what people like, but more importantly, it knows how to promote what they have. So, you know, they have both sides of the equation to make a piece of content more successful and have a higher hit rate than, let's say, HBO did in its early days. You know, it wasn't until, like, Sopranos and Six Feet Under and so on that HBO started getting a kind of a run of hits, whereas, you know, Netflix has had a higher, much higher percentage of successes. And it's partially due to knowing what people want, but it's even more driven by the ability to promote those titles to the right people, to the relevant people.
I think that's true, but also, to be fair, I think House of Cards was sort of A-B tested in some sense, in that it was successful already in the UK, like the earlier version. And then I think, if I'm not mistaken, the producer of House of Cards, or one of the writers, produced many HBO shows in the past. And I could be wrong. I forget the name completely.
You're right. But, you know, what's driving them to do this is actually an overall content cost reduction. You know, our original concept was that anything you wanted except for adult movies, you could find at Netflix. You know, we were going to have at least some of everything. And what they found is that whole long tail concept is interesting, but it really doesn't give an ROI, especially if you're having to have minimum guarantees as they are now with digital. So what makes people not quit your service is the idea that even if there's nothing to watch now, in 3 months there's going to be another series that's going to come out that you're going to love. And so, you know, everything Netflix does is about reducing churn. And what they found is that more importantly than having lots and lots of obscure titles licensed, it's more important to have this exclusive content that you know you want and you know you're not going to quit because you can't get it elsewhere.
So ultimately, and I think this is a valuable lesson to entrepreneurs, creating your own content is really critical, like whatever business you're in.
It is. It's the only way you're not, you know, subject to the whims or, you know, and this was a big problem at Redbox where, you know, I had to sue three studios. I was subject to them deciding whether or not they wanted us to survive. And, you know, we found a way around it, but you need to have your own content, your own creativity.
Right. Like ultimately, no matter what industry you're in, there's going to be gatekeepers. And you have to always constantly figure out ways to get around the gatekeepers.
Yeah, especially if you're gonna disrupt the market in some fashion, you're gonna create some enemies, you know, that want to stop you, and it's gonna make that even more critical.
So let's talk about Quarterly.co, where you're the current CEO. I think this is a great company. So I'm gonna just describe it for a second. You could correct me if I'm wrong. I have a pretty big platform. Like, I have a nice number of Twitter followers. I have a big email list, a lot of very friendly, and I'm grateful for the people who listen to this podcast. I would like to give back. I would like to say, here are my 10 favorite books that I read this quarter. I want to email it to everyone who's essentially paid me some sort of subscription fee that covers my costs and shipping and maybe a little extra. I want to give you all my favorite books. You guys kind of quarterly provides all of the infrastructure for me doing that. And I can create an entire business that could create income and maybe even wealth for me by using the quarterly infrastructure.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. There's really two components of it. One is, there is a lot of fascinating people out there that have really interesting ideas about what's cool and what things you should, you know, toys you should play with, what books you should read. that no one knows about. And in fact, what attracted to me to them originally was I was looking at their early curators, and I didn't know who any of them were. But when I read about them, I go, man, you know, this guy or this woman is doing something really fascinating. And so one aspect of it is to, you know, create a forum and a platform to find interesting people you may not know about. And the second part is exactly as you've described. It provides a way, kind of the under the covers difficulties of having your own distribution network, you know, creating that infrastructure where it's really just plug and play. If you want boxes shipped that are of this size with this many things in it, Quarterly has that all done for you. So,
like, I basically can give you a list of names and addresses and all the things I want in the box, and you put it all together and take care of all the logistics and shipping and all of that.
Yeah, exactly.
Creative uses also. Like, I like how Pharrell Williams, you know, the kind of hip-hop R&B artist, in his box, it was just his favorite book, The Alchemist, but with his personal annotations on each book. I thought that was brilliant.
Yeah, that's priceless. If you're a Pharrell fan, you know, you actually feel like you're getting his own personal copy loaned to you to be able to look at, to see what is it that, you know, attracted him to the book, and what are the passages in the book that he found interesting. Because it's, you know, it's handwritten post-it notes with his words on it pointing to a phrase in the book, and then we've reproduced those post-it notes so they look like the original ones that he put in the book. And of course they're put exactly where he had them in the book. It's really, really a cool thing.
So there's sort of an arbitrage there where that is not so expensive, even though maybe the subscription to him costs a lot more than the copy of The Alchemist, but there's an arbitrage because people want to know what Farrell's annotations were.
Exactly. And it kind of bridges the physical and digital, you know, divide, where, you know, you can listen to his music, you can hear him, see him on TV, but to actually touch and feel something that he believes is important and interesting, like a physical book, you know, that you have to actually ship. You can't, you know, send that through bits and bytes.
There's something kind of primal about that, too. It reminds me of, like, going to sleepaway camp and getting a care package from my parents. Like, it's something I could look forward to, and I could love it and enjoy it, and makes me feel nostalgic and whatever.
Yeah. Well, the founder, you know, Zach Prichette, who's the founder of Quarterly, and by the way, just one little correction. I'm still a big shareholder of Quarterly, but I've stepped down as the president. And the founder, Zach, runs it and is just an amazing leader of that company.
Wait, let me ask, like, is this, are we doing, playing in euphemisms here? Were you, like, fired or anything?
No, I wasn't fired. You know, my goal, I was brought in by the one of the investors, and to work with Zach. And my goal was to help Zach through the initial phases where, you know, it's difficult when it's the first time you're doing it, establishing priorities. And Zach is, you know, I mean, he's got this great vision. He's got a great sense of things. He just needed a partner to help him through the first couple of years and get the thing on its feet. And so a couple months ago, about a month and a half ago, I felt that he had it all down. In fact, I was more of a hindrance than help. So I offered to leave and left. But I'm still very involved and still very close to those guys. But day-to-day running of it, Zach and Aaron are doing.
Well, what I love about Quarterly is that someone could build an entire business on top of it. Like, if my brand is strong enough, meaning not necessarily personally, but maybe my corporate brand, if people trust me enough to curate good quality items for them in a quarterly box, then I could charge mm-hmm. more than what those things are worth for quarterly to box it all up and so on. So there's a big profit yeah. in there. And do you know people who have built businesses on top of quarterly?
Yeah, I mean there's people like Tim. You know, even though Tim Ferriss is a well-known author, he's essentially earning in the six figures his profit on his boxes per year, and he's doing that in two ways. One is the story that he tells by the items in the box are much more valuable than the kind of buying them piecemeal and putting them together. And then second, he leverages, his kind of tacit endorsement of the product with the vendor to get them at a much lower cost than, not much, but a lower cost than maybe wholesale might be. So, he's definitely in the six-figure range as far as the profit he's making on an annual basis based on that.
And I feel like a lot of people could start to do that. And again, there's an arbitrage. You need to have among your audience the trust that, there's two things that the audience is paying for. One is they're paying for the items in the box, and the other thing is they're paying for the trust in you that you're going to pick the right items for them that they don't know about. And
the story you're telling.
Right, the story you're telling, because again, Farrell didn't just put a copy of The Alchemist in his box. That would have been boring. But his personal annotations, that's interesting. Even if he wasn't Farrell, but somebody else, that would still be interesting.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And this is a huge trend in the world. It's like we're all out there these days building our own brand, whether it's on LinkedIn or Facebook. If we're authors or business people, we're all building a brand, and this is a way to monetize that brand. It's not the only way, but it's a way to physically connect with your fans so that they know more about you and potentially can buy other things from you.
Potentially you can get into kind of the information product space. So someone's going to say, okay, I'm willing to pay $10 a month for James's newsletter, special reports, his favorite, Kindles or whatever. Like you don't really do the digital thing so much, but you could do that.
Yeah, and there's from time to time, like Pharrell is really into luminosity, and so he'll put from time to time a gift card for Luminosity, a free subscription for Luminosity on a digital card in the package.
What is Luminosity?
It's the brain game, thing online where, they say you've got to exercise your brain. And so it's kind of tests and things to help make you smarter. What we find to be the most successful are where you have in the package things that couldn't be transmitted digitally, because almost all of our curators have big fan bases that, subscribe to their blogs or follow them in some other way. But, what you really got to do is take advantage of being able to, ship a physical object that represents something that's really important to you, that you're followers and the people who are interested in what you've got to say, that they'll find interesting.
Yeah, I really love the model. I mean, as soon as I heard it, I said to myself two things. Wow, that's a great business. And B, I really want to send a box every quarter to people who want it from me. Like I started thinking of all sorts of things I could put in my box, my quarterly box.
Yeah, and that's what it takes. It takes, someone like yourself who has lots of ideas and lots of thoughts and creativity. People are going to love what you create. We found that when we tried to go for big celebrities that, might have their assistant or agent come up with what was in it, the fans saw right through that. you know, they go, wait a minute, this is just another commercial representation of this person. This isn't the true deep thinking of the person who I admire. And that's why, you know, the ones that work, and that's why Pharrell is so good, is because he actually spends time thinking about this himself, as does Nina Garcia, you know, as does Bill Nye, the science guy, and Andrew Zimmern, Bizarre Foods. They all put, the ones that work, really put creative thought into it.
What did the Bizarre Foods guy put in his box?
He'll come up with, you know, like his favorite recipe for paella. But it won't just be the recipe. It'll be the ingredients. It'll be the special kitchen equipment you need to make it. And then some funny stories of, you know, how you do it and things that have happened to him and stuff, you know, while he's been doing it. But the key physical items are the actual ingredients, you know, things that, you know, he imports from Spain that you won't find at any store here, and special utensils, things like that.
Well, what other boxes have you found to be pretty creative?
You know, Nina Garcia's box is always amazing. She has all her friends who are designers. So whether it's, you know, sunglasses or, you know, jewelry or, you know, like accessories, there's all, you know, everything in there is like, you know, it's packed full of stuff that women just love, especially people who are into the fashion, you know, the kind of what's hip in fashion.
And what's another one?
There's, oh gosh, you're catching me at a dumb moment here.
That's okay. I'm fascinated by it.
I'd have to think about it. But there's, you know, everyone for us is like Christmas.
Tim Ferriss must have some good ones.
Yeah, he's got, you know, water purifiers and, you know, the absolute best way to make coffee with all the utensils, from a hand grinder to counting how many seconds, you know, it is to, you know, for each component of making the coffee. They're all different. Everyone is different.
So, you know, I have nothing to do with Quarterly. I'm not an investor. I've never really spoken to anybody from Quarterly. I do plan on doing my own Quarterly box, probably starting sometime in March or April. But what I do want to challenge my listeners, because there's no, it's not like you have to have 1,000 subscribers. Just think of having like your family as subscribers. Like, call up your friends and family, get 10 subscribers, and think of the box you want to put together. Do you have a minimum on number of subscribers?
It's in the hundreds, like 500 or so is the minimum. But that's like, for someone like yourself, that's quite easy. And by the way, these packages are probably the best gifts I've ever given anyone, because, you know, you never will find this, you know, in a store, or, you know, no one's going to have already gotten this gift before. They are absolutely the most creative and unique gifts. So, you know, you give one away, you give the second one away. You know, sometimes people take one item out and keep it and give the rest away. But they're fantastic gifts.
I should start a company, Quarterly Squared. So for $500 a quarter, I will send you the best items from every other Quarterly box.
That would be awesome. I bet people would love that.
So Mitch, I really appreciate you spending the time and coming on the show. I know we put this together really quickly, so I appreciate your time. What's next for you? What's after Quarterly?
Well, I'm realizing that I'm still drawn back to the entertainment space. You know, in particular, I love the way consumers pick movies and TV shows. And so I'm just kind of exploring. I don't have anything specific, but I realized that I want to get back into that business again. So, you know, I'm just trying to figure out exactly what that means, what to do.
Okay, well, great. Well, thanks again, Mitch. I really appreciate you coming on the show. Mitch Lowe, co-founder of Netflix, former president of Quarterly, founder of Redbox. You've done so much stuff on the internet that we've all heard of, And I really appreciate you giving us your lessons and experience.
Thank you. Yeah, it was great talking to you.
Thanks, Mitch. Bye.
For more from James, check out the James Altucher Show on the Stansberry Radio Network at stansberryradio.com and get yourself on the free insiders list today.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.